Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a response of the day for the 8th day of Tevet. Today we're going to see a couple of tshuvot. We could have just seen the 3DH on a really interesting case that came up in the late 1940s, early 1950s, but we have a tshuva of the Bach, and since the Bach is a tshuvot, this is in the 1500s, this is a tshuva from Shin Zion, which is late 1546, early 1547. It's from the 8th of Tevet. So I always use my opportunities to get tshuvot of the Bach because I think it's so interesting that he already started dating his tshuvot in ways that, as far as I can tell, earlier people did not. And he doesn't always do it, but he at least sometimes does it. And so there's a tshuva in the Bach that we'll see. Then we're going to move through history. There's a tshuva in the Chatam Sofer that we'll see, and then a brief tshuva. We'll see briefly a tshuva in the Svidei H. I want to thank Rabbi Jack Abramowitz, David Hachhauser, and the OU for making this year available to you online. So the response of the Bach is the Shut Banach Hayishanot, the older ones, the earlier version, Simon Tzadi Gimel. I want to make clear that by older, I don't mean that there's a later version. I mean that there's a first set and then a later set, and they call them the Shut Banach Hadashot when you come up with a new set of them. They're different names for when you have new volumes of something. So this is response number 93. It's about a Kohen. So the fact that he's a Kohen is important because if you divorce a woman as a Kohen, so you can never remarry her. I think that's part of the issue that you want to mention. He's a Kohen, he's an Ashkenazi, and that's going to be relevant to the question of how we pasken on a certain halakhic question. His wife, first she had two children, and then she went insane. She's so insane that they have to lock her in an inner room, a cheder b'to cheder. They have to lock her in an inner room. Now, I've thought about this for a while, that I think that there are certain words that we use, and we assume they mean the same thing throughout human history, but I'm not convinced at all that they do, and insanity is one of those words. Meaning, I have no idea what this woman's insanity is. It could be that you'd see her today, and you'd say, oh, she has this and this and this, and you treated this in this way, but it could be that it's something completely different than we know, and in fact, it wasn't treatable, and I have no confidence that it's always the same exact thing. I think we often assume that, no, it's all the same unless we know it's different, and I'm not sure. But take for granted that they didn't know what to do with her. As far as they were concerned, she was insane. Sometimes she recovered her sanity, ulitim chaluma, for a week, even 2 weeks. And then she goes back to whatever caused the insanity. I remember I saw a bunch of years ago a movie called The Madness of King George III. And at the end of the movie, they said that they thought that his madness was porphyria, which is actually a physical disease, not a psychological disease, but it has the effect of also making somebody insane. And you watch them try to treat him for it, and they don't succeed, and there's always an interesting question as to whether we would really do better, because if it was porphyria today, we know what to do about it. So then you'd always wonder about, is it the exact same thing back then as it is today? Has it changed or not? But this woman is insane. She's living with her father and her brothers, and the husband has their two children. He's taking care of the two children. It's a bunch of years. All right, this is going on. He is basically unmarried and yet unable to marry anybody else. So he's sitting alone. And halacha, I think we've seen in this series, halacha hates to leave people alone. If women are stuck with their husbands having disappeared, we try to find all the ways we can to help them. We've seen halachas, and we'll see a tshuva today in the CDH, trying to help the women find their way to married satisfaction and happiness. And the same thing is for a man. So you have this man, he's sitting alone, and he wants to know, can he force a divorce on her, at least at a time when she is sane? Now, it happens to be that when she's sane, I think it's either in this tshuva or another, I've seen another tshuva, when she's sane, when she's in her right mind, she doesn't want to get divorced because she's hoping this time she'll do it. Years ago, I read a memoir by a remarkable woman in California. It's called, I think, The Center Cannot Hold, and she's a schizophrenic. When she wrote the book, she's in her 60s, and I think the story is that a lot of schizophrenics sort of burn out, and by the time they get to their 50s, 60s, and 70s, their symptoms are not as bad as they once were. But she writes about the fact that when she would go on her medication, she would be fine, but then she would repeatedly convince herself that she didn't need the medication. She'd go off the medication and then have a terrible episode of schizophrenia, and it would be terrible for her. Now, she eventually found herself to a remarkable life. She was a law professor, mostly a research professor, but for a while a teaching professor, and whatever. But the idea that people who have serious mental issues, serious mental problems, can also convince themselves that this time it's different, that's a part of it. So here, too, I think that she didn't want to accept. It wasn't like she was willing to say when she was Beit Chalumata, when she was in her right mind, she was willing to say, okay, you're right, we have to get divorced. She wants, she doesn't want to get divorced. He wants to know, can he marry, can he force a divorce on her? Now we, since the by Torah law, a man is able to force a divorce on his wife, but part of Chayim Rabbeinu Gershom was that we don't do that anymore. That was one option that he wanted to raise. Or maybe, could he marry a second wife? That again is an issue where Torah law allows marrying a second wife, but Chayim Rabbeinu Gershom said that he could not. So he wants to break some aspect of Chayim Rabbeinu Gershom because he doesn't want to be stuck with no married life in his life. He says the Sephardim in Salonika. Now, I think this man might have been living in Salonika, but he's an Ashkenazi. That was said at the beginning of the response. So he doesn't necessarily want to follow Sephardi Pesach. The Sephardim in Salonika had said that they think that giving her a get against her will is the better way to transgress or to void the Chayim Rabbeinu Gershom as were, because that way at least she's not Naguna. Meaning if she ever recovers, then she can get married also because she's divorced now. And they thought that was better than having him just be allowed to marry a second wife. And I have to say, it might not have been true back then, already known back then, but nowadays, whenever somebody is allowed to marry a second wife by virtue of voiding Chayim Rabbeinu Gershom for that particular case, they always leave a get with the court so that if she ever gets better, the get can be given to her. So that concern isn't as much a concern, but apparently back then they hadn't had then come up with that solution yet, and therefore they thought it was better to divorce her against her will. Bach says he thinks in this case that's not the correct psak, because that makes an assumption about divorcing a woman who is sometimes insane and sometimes not. It's impossible. Not that we don't allow it. Not that Chayim Rabbeinu Gershom doesn't allow for it. It's impossible to divorce a woman who's literally insane all the time. But there's a machloket in the Gemara about why that is. One option in the Gemara is that's because of what's called gerera, that we're worried that if you divorce a woman like that, and she's not in her right mind, that people will take, men will take physical advantage of her, that she'll become the kind of woman who people just make use of, and it seems like that's a meaningful, I mean, it seems like, I've heard of cases in our time, that's a meaningful possibility, that unfortunately, aside from the difficulties of their mental health issues, that women with mental health issues, maybe some men with mental health issues, but certainly women with mental health issues, are vulnerable to predators who will take advantage of them, use them for their own sexual desires. So that's Rishum Gerei, right? That's one possibility for why it's impossible to divorce a woman who's in her right mind. The other one is Mishum Sheina Yechola Lishimor Gita, that she doesn't know, she's not able, not that she doesn't know, she's not able to care for her get. She's not able to observe the strictures of the get, meaning she doesn't understand what it means to get divorced, that she'll know that she no longer lives with her husband, that he's no longer her husband, that marriage, that relationship has been broken. So the person who says it's because of the sexual problems, because she'll become vulnerable to predators, for that person, even if there are times when she's sane, you can't allow them, it's not true that she can get divorced, because when she's not sane, she'll be vulnerable to predators. So that would be a reason, says the Bach, if you're going to allow this husband to give her a divorce against her will at a time when she is sane, you're taking a stand on the reason why insane women are not able to, we are not able to, there is no possibility of divorce for insane women, but it's a machloket gemara that we haven't really paskened on. And therefore, the Bach says, and he says he's seen it from his teachers, that the our common talk, his talk they knew, was to prefer allowing this husband to marry a second wife in this situation. And he says, and I think, and my understanding is that when Rabbeinu Gershom made these original takanot, made these original rules, he included in it. Now, that's the whole, whether historians agree with what the Bach is about to say or not, I think they would largely not. First of all, I think historians largely think that what we call Chayim Rabbeinu Gershom actually didn't happen in the time of Rabbeinu Gershom. It didn't come from the pen of Rabbeinu Gershom, as it were. Came sometime relatively soon after that, and then was attributed to him in terms of getting prestige. Whoever came up with it, the Bach is arguing that that person had included in it the assumption that when things go wrong, such that there's a reason to, that there's a good, valid, important reason to ignore the strictures of Rabbeinu Gershom, that you can, except that you do it b'haskamat me'ar rabbanim. You have to have 100 rabbis agree to it, and they have to come from 3 different lands. And the point is, says the Bach, and this is back in the 1500s, let's remember, that it shouldn't be the simple thing to do such things, to break Rabbeinu Gershom, which should be a possibility. It's not that he was objecting to it, but he wanted to make sure that it took enough consultation, that it would go through enough hands and see enough eyes, that if there were a problem here, people would raise the problem. Therefore, that's what he says here too, with this Reuven, and also he has the idea that I mentioned before, to leave the money for her ketubah with the communal administrators, with people in the community who take care of these things, And I think he must have he might mention a get, although I don't see it right here, but I think so. And he says, and I don't need to prove it so much because there are, and I don't want to go into proofs because there are people who disagree with me. He knows a Maharshal, for example, seems to disagree, but he says the Maharshal was only speaking specifically about marrying about divorcing her against her will when she was sane, but that's not the solution that he is promoting. So he thinks that maybe he would agree that if you're going to marry a second wife, there's not going to be an actual divorce, that should be okay. And he points out that the Ramah, he calls him HaRab Agat Shulchan Aruch, I think I'm pretty sure it's the Ramah, who says that there's a situation where she's insane, that you can be mekel and allow him to marry another woman, and that's the minhag. And he says, and when I was younger, there was a group of people who included me in the Heter Meir Rabbanan. So I've seen it happen, and this is a long-standing tradition, this is what we do, and therefore that's what I think we should do in this situation as well. And as support, one last support for that, we'll say again, for the 8th of Tevet, for Shin Zion 15, 46-47, he quotes the Rabbeinu Eliezer Mimetz, who's the Yireim, which is who's a Talmud of Rabbeinu Tam. So he's the early to mid 12th century, which is going back a ways and is much closer to when Chayim Rabbeinu Gershom was promulgated. That, and he had a situation sometimes when, remember that part of Rabbeinu Gershom is not to marry two wives. What if a man's married and sadly his brother passes away without children? Brother passes away without children, he's supposed to, by theoretical Torah law, he's supposed to either marry the widow, which by Torah's law is allowed because he's allowed to have two wives by Torah law, or give her a chalitza. Problem with giving her a chalitza in this situation is once Rabbeinu Gershom comes along and says you're not allowed to marry two wives, Rabbeinu Eliezer Mimetz worried that that might be a chalitza pisula, that it might not be a valid chalitza, because we have a principle that in any case where you can't have a marriage, you can't have a chalitza. The chalitza only works where Yibum was a meaningful possibility. Since Yibum was a meaningful possibility because he was married to one wife already, and Rabbeinu Gershom said he couldn't marry a second wife, so the Yireim worried that the chalitza would be psula, the chalitza would be invalid, and therefore he would sometimes have the Yabam actually marry her, he would say, and this is the key point for our point, is that b'mako mitzvah lo nigzer gzeira. The Chayim Rabbeinu Gershom is never meant to get in the way of the fulfillment of mitzvot. So that's the first tshuva we have. It's a bach, a relatively short tshuva, about a man whose wife went insane. The fundamental answer is, we do have to marry a bunny, but it shows us a couple of issues. One, that the Sephardim of the time in Salonika held that divorcing a woman against her will was the better solution. We saw the reasons why divorcing a woman against her will creates problems in terms of halacha. And then we saw the idea of Het HaMeir Rabbanim. That's the Bach in 1547. The Chatam Sofer, on the 8th of Tevet of Tav Kuf Tzadi Dalin of 1833 to 34, I'm pretty sure it's late 1833, Chatam Sofer in Chelek Dalin Evan Ezer Bet Simon Peitet, he has another situation of problematic, difficult finding ways to let people out of marriages or into other marriages that are problematic. In this situation, it's a binyan zikukali abam mumar. So, as I've learned from these Jewot, the idea of Jews leaving Judaism was not an invention of the 20th century. Unfortunately, it was not an invention of the 20th century. It was an invention of the 19th century. It happened, unfortunately and sadly, it happened in all the generations. That's why Chazal already know what Mumarim are. They know how to speak about Mumarim. People who have abandoned observance have left the religion. And that creates many issues. One issue is that person themselves. Another issue is that it's a blow to the community. But it creates much more, also much more specific and very tangible issues. In this case, you have a woman who's married to a man. Sadly, the man passes away without children, and this happened a lot more in the olden days, it seems like, than it does today. But man passes away without children. The wife needs a yibum or a chalitza from a brother. What if the only brother is a mumar? So what does that mean? It means he's abandoned observance. If he's abandoned observance, he doesn't care to do this stupid, what he calls stupid ceremony, you know, this ritual with her, and he may live far away, and it creates all sorts of problems. So this woman is a zikukali yibum liyabam mamar. What we would have done about that, halachically, is an interesting question. There's a whole debate about that issue as well that the Chatam Sofer will somewhat reference in this responsum from the 8th of Tevet of Tav Kuf Tzadi Dalet. But now the situation was that the daughter of the Yabam has come along, and she says her father has passed away. So can we trust her? Meaning, the Yabam Mumar was a problem for us, but can we trust the daughter? So Chatam Sofer points out that the Mishnah Yevamot lists people who we don't trust about these issues. We don't trust the mother-in-law or the daughter of her husband to talk about the death of a man in terms of creating Yibum. And that's the first discussion in Yevamot. It's about the fact that these women, it comes up a little bit in this Yibum as well, it's about either these women hate this woman so much, this meaning the Mishnah and the Gemara assume that there was a competitiveness to these relationships, that because they're sort of vying for the affections of the man or the attention of the man in question, that we, or that there's ill will and tension created sometimes. The point isn't that it always happens that way. The point is that it happens often enough that Halacha felt that it had to worry about that. And therefore, if one of these women comes along and says, "Oh, you know, my husband died," we worry, well, either we worry that the wife is going to be too quick to listen to it and she'll do something she didn't do when he wasn't really dead, or we might worry that these other women will actually say something that's not true, because then this woman will go off and do something about it. Let's say she'll get a yibum or a chalitza, she'll get remarried, and then the halacha is, if she's had even accidentally, if she's had an affair, we generally will say that she can't return to her previous husband, and therefore these women will have gotten rid of her, this woman, from their lives. That's the Gemara doesn't say it happens all the time, it happens often. It only says it happens often enough that we have to worry about it. So when this daughter of the Mumar comes along and says she heard her father died, are we allowed to believe her? She's one of those who are psulot leha'id, who are not accepted or not believed to give testimony. Mishum disanya le'itita, she doesn't like this woman. Because she's eating up her inheritance, as it were. Right? Let's say a man is a multimillionaire. He loses his first wife, you know, at a ripe old age. Decides to marry somebody else. So what do the kids think? This woman's eating into our inheritance. So that experience, it doesn't mean about all children, it doesn't mean about all wives, but it happens. And so that's what happens here. So we have to worry that's maybe that's going on, that we can't trust her. And it's a discussion in the Gemara, the reason for it is unclear. And then another aspect of it that makes it unclear is what happens if it's not the daughter of her current husband, but it's the daughter of a future husband. So that's the Bat HaYabam, meaning this woman isn't even her father's wife yet. She's not even, right, she's a zikuka liyabam. She needs something from him, but it's not necessarily yibum. It could be chalitza. So that would also muddle the picture. Does she really care so much about this woman who really likely won't be part of her life, or certainly isn't yet part of her life? Is that enough of a reason that she'll lie about it? The Rif and the Rambam left the whole question out. So it seems like they think likula, that you can trust the daughter of the future Yabam, because there's not enough of a relationship there, they have to worry about it. But the Rush and the Tur were Machmir, and the Ramah agrees to that Chumrah. So the Chassan Sofer is talking to Ashkenazim, so it seems like we should follow the Chumrah of the Ramah and maybe not believe the daughter of the Yabam. But there's another complication here as well, which is that the whole idea that, I'm sorry, there is another idea that the Rush mentioned, which is that maybe we don't trust any individual, any lone witness when it comes to a yaba. So the reason to think about that is, let's remember that halacha, really, it's supposed to take two witnesses to establish halachic fact. And that should theoretically mean that before a woman could decide her husband or her yabam, the man that she needed a yibum or chalitza with, had passed away, you needed the testimony of two witnesses. However, when it comes to husbands, Chazal said that you can trust one. It's already in the Gemara, you can trust one witness. And that's because a lot of times, unfortunately, when people, men, pass away, there might only have been one person around to see it or to know about it. And then if you stick with the Torah's requirements of two, you end up, Chazal is saying the Torah allowed for this, that if the Torah insists on two for those situations, then you end up with a lot of women who are agunot in the classical sense of it, meaning they just literally couldn't remarry because they couldn't know what it has to their husbands. So when the halacha became that, oh, you can trust one witness in those situations, the Rush said that didn't apply to a yabam situation, to a situation where the man who might have passed away is the man who's supposed to either marry or do chalitza. And the reason he gave was ha'isha lo daika, that the woman won't be careful in that situation because she's not happy about having to worry about this yabam, maybe having to marry him, or about having a chalitza with him. The whole situation is bothersome to her, so if she hears some information that maybe he passed away, she might act on that already. And part of when Chazal said that you can believe one witness is that they assume that Aisha Daika Ominsama, that the women, that the widow, before she remarried, would really do everything that she could. I mean, they assume, for all the negative stuff we've had today, I think this is part of a positive assumption, they assume that her connection to her existing husband was so strong that if she hears rumors that he passed away, she's not going to get remarried. That before she would get remarried, she would really, really check it out. And if we can trust her that she's really, really going to check it out, then even one witness could be good enough, since we can trust her. But the Rush held, well, that doesn't apply to a Yabam. doesn't apply when the man in question is a man who she was going to have to either marry or do chalitza with. So that the Rosh felt wasn't an issue. And then when it came to the daughter of the Abam, if we think that the daughter is a problem, let's remember it says the Chatam Sofer, the reason that would be a problem is that we think such women would actually lie because they dislike their competitor woman who's eating up their inheritance and things like that. So you got, so the Chatam Sofer says, it seems like you have what's called a Sveik Sveik Lechachmir. Normally when we use the word Sveik Sveik, what we mean is it creates a double doubt that allows us to be more lenient. We don't be stringent about this issue because this might be true that lets it be not stringent, and even if there's not enough evidence that this is true, this other thing might be true. And once we have two things that might be true, Lekula, so we always say Sveik Sveik Lechumra, but Lekula, but in our situation, it seems like you have Sveik Sveik Lechumra. A woman comes along and says, the man you were supposed to marry has passed away. So we think, oh, well, ordinarily, when we say, want to know if a man has passed away, in terms of marriage issues, we say, well, one witness can do it. Here now we have a Sveik Sveik Lechumra. Sveik one is, can you rely on one witness in the situation? The Rosh holds you can't rely on one witness in the situation because the woman, the widow in this situation, will not be as careful as most women are, because it's, after all, a question of a future marriage and to somebody she never committed to wanting to be married to. It's sort of halacha put in that situation because her husband passed away without children. Don't know if we can trust that. And number two, that's question number one. Is one witness going to be okay? And this daughter of the Abam is one witness. And number two, she's a daughter. And we've said that the daughter of husbands might not be good. It might be that she's okay here because it's a future husband rather than an existing husband. But we generally assume the daughters of husbands are not good witnesses in terms of freeing wives to go off and marry somebody else. Now, that's all reasons why we might think we have to be machmir, we have to be stringent. But the Mahari Mintz says the Chatam Sofer. The Mahari Mintz, and already, which is, you know, 300-400 years before the Chatam Sofer, the Mahari Mintz raised the possibility that once it became true that Ashkenazim, at least, never do Yibum, Sfaradim do Yibum, I think even up until this day, we've seen a tshuva, I've recorded a tshuva for Vayu Yosefs, where he talks about the fact that he thinks that even today, Sfaradim, whose custom is to do Yibum, if the couple wants to do Yibum, so they'll do Yibum even today, and he did so even in the face of the chief rabbinate ruling against it. Vayu Yosef held that was a wrong ruling of the chief rabbinate, who refused to abide by it. So, but Ashkenazim, for hundreds of years, have not done Yibum at all. So the Mahari Mintz says, well, once you don't do Yibum at all, then maybe the worry that the daughter would dislike this wife because, after all, she might marry her father, maybe that worry goes away because there isn't any real meaningful worry that she's going to marry the father. So when this daughter of the Yabam Mumar comes and says, you know, my father passed away, there's no reason to worry that she's lying about it to trip this woman, because this woman's nothing to her. The most this woman needed, this woman who was her aunt, by the way, and the most this woman needed from the husband, from the possible dead husband, dead Mumar, is chalitza. And therefore, he thinks that maybe that whole issue would go away. Tzemach Tzedek disagreed. Tzemach Tzedek was also an important Akron. There's a Tzemach Tzedek who's a Lubavitcher Rebbe. That's what the Chatam Sofer means, because he was living right around then. He means there's an old Tzemach Tzedek from like 1500, 1600, who was a recognized and respected halachic authority. Not that the Tzemach Tzedek Lubavitch wasn't. I'm just saying it's another Tzemach Tzedek. And the Tzemach Tzedek disagreed because he said the reason why we're allowed to trust one witness at all when it comes to allowing a woman to marry and assume that her husband has passed away, but that was, he said, because of Afkeinu Rabbanan Likidushin Mine. It's because there's a thing in the Gemara, and the 3 days we're going to talk about a little bit, so we'll get to that in a minute. There's a thing in the Gemara that says that sometimes Chazal are allowed to say, well, when you got married, you said the words Kedat Moshe Yisrael. You said, I'm getting married according to the rules of Moshe and Israel. And if Chazal later come to decide that that whole marriage should have been uprooted from the beginning, then they have that power to do it. When they do and when they don't is a hard, important question that comes up, as we'll see in the 3 days, comes up in our times as well. So the Tzemach Tzedek said, so when Chazal said that one witness can uproot it, they put rules on that, they put limits on that. So even if the situation has changed such that you'd imagine that they would have allowed to uproot this marriage as well, because there's no reason not to, doesn't matter because we don't have the today to uproot marriages in that way. Chazal says he's not sure he agrees with the Tzemach Tzedek. He's had a whole chiddush, and on the time the Rambam holds that it's a d'oraita halacha. That when we say one witness is valid for verifying, for certifying the passing of a husband or a yabam, that's not in afkeinu situation. Not Chazal came along on the root of the marriage. It's the Torah law allowed for that, as I said earlier in this tape. And the Chazal says, but we're actually in a different situation here because this is a yabam mumar. So A, there's no expectation he's going to marry her ever, and B, He might not even be willing to do a chalitza, but also he's not a mumar that we can force to live up to our halachic practices. So if he decides to just not be involved in the situation at all, she'll be completely stuck. And that creates certain kulas, the chatam sofer things. That creates certain kulas, certain leniencies, because we can't do anything about it. And so therefore the eight echad situation, the fact that we can accept one witness, he thinks that there's more than enough room to say that we can in this situation, that we don't even have to worry about the fact that she is the daughter, his daughter, for the reason that he said. He thinks you can follow the lenient positions on these things. Especially since he said there's a machloket, not ancient, but going back to the time of the Gaonim, Rav Yehudai Gaon, who's living in the 8th century, so Rav Yehudai Gaon held that when it comes to Zika and Mumar, and it's a reminder that there have been Mumar and people who left the religion all throughout Jewish history, perhaps the percentages go up and down at various times in Jewish history, but there have always been people like that around. Rav Yehudai Gaon said that if the only living brother, only surviving brother of the husband who passed away with their children is a Mumar, she doesn't have to worry about it at all. Meaning it's not just that she doesn't have to do a Yibum with him, she doesn't have to wait for a Chalitza from him. And that's the Rav Yehudai Gaon held that way because he held that when the woman got married, she had no intention of committing herself to waiting around for a Yibum or a Chalitza from a guy who doesn't care about the religion. Rav Yehudai Gaon held that was true even if the brother left observance after the marriage, meaning if it was true at the time of the marriage, you can assume it's an implicit condition of the marriage. But it happens after the marriage, it's hard to imagine that. Rav Shri Yogan, in fact, disagreed. He thought that if it was a mumar at the time of Nisuyan, at the time of marriage, that would be true, but if it was afterwards, then not. So that at least gives enough room that he doesn't think we have to worry. One of the worries about a mumar might be we'd have to worry that he comes to his senses and not his, like, official mental health sense, but his religious senses, and realize that he should return to the religion and be maharher b'tshuva. The moment that he's maharher b'tshuva, that he thinks to himself, you know what, I really should go back to being Jewish, then the zika, his recurrent need for a yibum or a chalitza from him, comes back in full force. So maybe we should have to worry that that's what happened, but Rav the Chatam Sofer thinks that we don't have to worry because of all the complications of the situation here, there's no reason we have to worry that that's what happened. And therefore, he thinks there are more than enough doubts to say that she can assume that he is in fact dead based on the testimony of the daughter, even though that's complicated, based on the fact that he was a mumar, even though that's complicated, but with all the complications, there's enough room to say that she can remarry. So the truth is, and I know how long it was going to take me to explain these important and valuable tshuvot, I wouldn't have mentioned the Shri Deish at all because we're running out of time, but and I could have ended, 3 minutes early and gotten some credit with you for ending a little early one day. But since I mentioned it, let me briefly talk about Shut Sri the Eish Chelik Aleph Simon Sadi, the first volume, the response number 90, which is dated the 8th of Tevet of Tovshin Yud Zayin of 1956, when the Sri the Eish is already of a relatively advanced age. And he's responding to Rav Herzog, who's also of a fairly advanced age, the chief rabbi of the state of Israel. And there are these four women in Petach Tikva who, when the Aliyah from Yemen happened, when the Jews were all getting out of Yemen, their husbands, instead of leaving Yemen, decided to convert to Islam. And they wanted their wives to convert with them as well, but the women instead managed to escape with their children. They ran away to Aden, Aden, which is near Yemen, and then they got to Israel, and there's no way to get out of the husbands now. There's not even a way to get an authorization out of the husband. Rav Herzog writes that he had tried hard to do it, and he doesn't know what to do about it, so he is trying to find ways to free them. So Rav Herzog advanced a few reasons, and he says he's turning to the Sri Deish, because the Sri Deish is a very knowledgeable man, an expert in issues of Mumar and Gittin, which means that there were, certainly in that time, in the 50s, enough people who had left the religion, they had needed experts on that situation of how you can or cannot get Gittin out of people who had abandoned the religion. So Rav Herzog suggests and says that the basis of his idea that maybe these women can ignore their marriage to these husbands, even without any kind of a get, that there are Geonim who hold in the Torah that even the marriage of a Mumar is what's called, it's only the Chumrah. It's a meaning that we don't really think it takes effect because they're a Mumar, they're not really Jewish anymore. And that's, well, so that's a whole question, right? Is a Mumar fully Jewish, or what level of fully Jewishness? Now, there's a well-known idea that Rashi said when it came to a Zika of Mumar that we just discussed in the Tshuvat Chatam Sofer, that the living brother is a Mumar. Does the woman have to worry about Yibum or Chalitza at all? So Rashi had mentioned this principle that we invoke many, many situations and we believe in it in many, many halakhic ways. Af pi shechata Yisraelu, that even though somebody has sinned, somebody has sinned terribly and greatly and broadly, they're nonetheless a Jew in some important ways. But there are others who hold not that, who held not that way, that you didn't have to worry about the Zika of Amor. So even though we follow Rashi in a lot of ways, so the Rav Herzog says, but the Taz points out that when we say that, first of all, there's a principle in that even in Torah law, if you have a shadat chak, if you have some extreme pressure, and these four poor women, these poor four women, or these women in Petah Tikva, who are going to be abandoned forever, not able to ever marry anybody unless we find some kind of solution for them, so that's a shadat chak, right? There is no other options out there. So shadat chak times, we can rely on loan opinions that we ordinarily don't. That's one of the reasons why loan opinions are worth knowing, because there are times when, even though, by and large, we wouldn't trust the Torah of Yehuda Gaon against all the weight of everybody in halacha, there are situations where we do. That's part of the shadat chak version of halachic psak, of ruling on halachic issue. In addition, and this is part of the Taz reason for why we're allowed to do that, is that when we say we follow the majority and the consensus opinion, that halacha really, although we do it all the time, but that halacha really only fully applies when that group of people had a chance to discuss the issue with each other. But if you have a debate in which nobody managed to talk to each other, just people wrote up their opinion, other people saw earlier people's opinions and argued against it, but never got the chance to hear what those people would have responded to that in all the situations, so there, you're allowed to rely, he thinks, you're allowed to rely on lone opinions. In addition, says Rav Herzog, Moshe Mordechai Epstein had said that, had come to the belief that we have halacha about Korban Pesach, this is called Ben Nechar Lo Yochal Bo, that somebody, Unkelus says, and it's true in halacha, that somebody who has abandoned the religion can't be part of a Korban Pesach, which I think is interesting in terms of thinking about how you'd have a Korban Pesach in the future, where that's true, where people who don't realize, or they don't think that they've left religion, but we think they've left religion, they won't come and they want to offer Korban Pesach. But Moshe Mordechai Epstein and Shut Levush Mordechai said that you see there that the Torah called a mumar to Avodah Zarah, somebody who really abandoned the religion and joined another religion, a Ben Nechar, a stranger, as if he's completely not religious anymore. He took that literally. Hifkia kol hakurvot. He removed all the relationships, and his kedushin doesn't count as kedushin anymore. And then Rav Shlomo Kluger said something similar about that. That if a mumar married somebody, then becomes a mumar, they don't work. And they go away because we say adati derabbanan mikadesh. That when somebody gets married, they do it adata derabbanan, that with the agreement of Chazal. And Chazal don't want a marriage in which one person is now completely not part of the religion. So Rav Herzog says that's a tremendous chiddush, because theoretically that would mean if it was a mumar, they left the religion and then they came back, then they should maybe, theoretically, by halakha standards, according to this, be allowed to marry their sisters, because you can say they became a non-Jew, and now they're like, they converted. So Rav Herzog says he didn't really fully rely on that. So I'm really running out of time, unfortunately. It's a much longer tshuva than we'll have a chance to get to. But it deals with many of these same issues in terms of how you can or can't get around a get or a problematic marriage. One option is to rely on afkinu. There's a whole question today about whether we allow ourselves to come up with new afkinu questions, new situations where we say, well, Chazal didn't want that marriage, and therefore they uprooted it. Rav Zisri Deish talks about that issue. He doesn't mention that his student, Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz, has suggested putting a t'nai in the kedushin to begin with, it should go away, and saying afkinu, and that the Zisri Deish was uncomfortable and leery of doing that. That's one big issue that's discussed. And another big issue that's discussed, which the Zisri Deish seems to think you can do in this situation, is the question of zachin adam shelo b'fanav, zachin me adam shelo b'fanav. Can we write a get for this man, for these men, and say that it's to their benefit, even when they would say it's not to their benefit, even when they would say, no, we don't want these women being freed because we think they should be staying with us here in Yemen and joining in our family. Does that matter? Does that count? So that's a whole big question. Eventually, the Shidayesh thinks that that's the way that you have to go. You have to say that Zachin Me Adam in this situation, that you can write a get for these four women. The Beitin can say, we are confident that it's better for these husbands to let their wives go than to let them go. But these are complicated situations. Now, remember, they're complicated situations, except that the only real ramification for them is for these four women, and the men that they choose to marry. The men they choose to marry will have to trust that the psak of the Sri Deish and the psak of Herzog is strong enough that they can get married, and then have to trust that their children will find other people who will be willing to marry them. Won't say, oh, no. Your mother's divorce wasn't good. You're a mom's, or I can't marry you. But they will trust Rav Herzog and Rav Zisri Deish well enough to allow that to happen. After a few generations, it won't be known anymore, and they're free enough to worry about it. But that's the situation that comes up. So, for the eighth day of Teveh, we had a couple of situations where people were stuck with spouses who were deep problems. You had the Bach with a wife who was no longer in her right mind, sadly, or at least often enough that the marriage could not continue. You had the Chatam Sofer talking about the possibility that a yabam mumar, that a person who should have been, a man who should have been doing yibum but had left the religion, might have died. And then you have the situation of absolutely agreeing they have living husbands, but they're complete mumar, they've abandoned the religion. Is there any way to free their wives from that? Those are responses from the 8th of Teve. Have a great day.